How can we explain the disparity in allergies in kids around the world?
Are the 40 million people who use a common antibiotic at risk of sudden death?
One more aspect of surgery versus PT for some aspect of the knee.
And new screening recommendations for HIV.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical news from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 2nd, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, so I served up in kind of an awkward fashion, though, another aspect of the knee, that's meniscal tears. We talked before about the anterior cruciate ligament and whether those respond better to surgery or physical therapy. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
These meniscal or cartilage tears frequently occur in people that have osteoarthritis of the knee. It affects about 250 million people, and it's a leading contributor to disability worldwide. The current therapies include arthroscopic surgery, and then if there's a meniscal tear, to actually debride or reconstruct that meniscus, to kind of chisel it down a little bit. And many individuals are referred for the surgery, but the real question is whether that procedure is actually better or the same as just doing physical therapy. So that question was asked and answered in a multi-center randomized trial of individuals over the age of 45. They had to have MRI evidence that they had a meniscal tear, and they were randomized to either surgery and physical therapy afterwards or just to a standardized physical therapy regimen alone. And the patients were followed after 6 to 12 months. And by the way, those that were randomized to the physical therapy, they could cross over to surgery if that was thought to be necessary. Both groups experienced an improvement in symptoms, and there was no benefit of surgery over the more conservative physical therapy. Now, in fairness, 30% of the individuals crossed over. The interesting thing is that varied from site to site. Some sites, no patients crossed over, and other sites, as many as 60%. So it's not really clear that surgery in those individuals was really necessary or not.
So once again, devolves back to that standpoint I've taken so many times, which is the watch and wait approach, and let's see what happens. Let's utilize physical therapy, let's be conservative, and let's see whether or not we can avoid having to have surgery.
And it seems like in this patient population, if you assume the crossovers were necessary, that means 70% of individuals did not need surgery. They responded to physical therapy alone. And it follows on other studies that show that surgery for osteoarthritis alone isn't beneficial. And this shows that osteoarthritis with meniscal tears don't necessarily require surgery either.
I guess it's hard to tell somebody who's in pain, you're going to have to wait a little while here, and we're going to send you to PT, and we're going to see if that ends up being beneficial. I suspect, however, that as we're embracing evidence-based medicine and we have lots more folks taking a look at the bottom line, we're going to say, hey, there's going to be an obligatory period of PT before we refer you for surgery.
I also need to remind our listeners, surgery itself carries a risk. What the study shows is that a conservative approach, physical therapy approach, offered initially can be a very reasonable alternative in many patients.
Okay, I like that message. Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, why don't we turn to another study, a look at azithromycin, a pretty common antibiotic, and cardiovascular disease.
When we say a common antibiotic, and this particular one is in a class called macrolide antibiotics, azithromycin in 2011 alone was prescribed to 40.3 million people in the United States, roughly one-eighth of the population. And it's primarily used for upper respiratory tract infections and bronchitis and even for pneumonia. In 2012, there was an observational study that suggested that this antibiotic was associated with an increased risk of sudden cardiac death. If individuals were at high risk, they had multiple risk factors for cardiovascular disease, their risk was 1 in 4,100 prescriptions. If they were at low risk, it was 1 in 100,000 prescriptions. That observational study set up this study, which was performed in Denmark, involving Danish adults between the ages of 18 to 64 years who had filled prescriptions for antibiotics, some of them for azithromycin and, by the way, some for penicillin. And they compared the azithromycin group to patients who received no antibiotics. And what they discovered was that individuals that received azithromycin were at a higher risk of death. Now, you might say, well, is that because they had an infection or was that because of the antibiotic? Then we go to this next stage. They compared azithromycin to penicillin, and there was no increased risk at all. So in this population-wide study, azithromycin use was not associated with an increased risk of death from cardiovascular causes.
Well, this is, of course, really good information, and it's also not really a surprise that people who already have risk factors for cardiovascular disease would experience a greater rate of mortality.
Except that with this particular antibiotic, there's concern that it can cause an EKG abnormality. Physicians would know it as QT prolongation, that can lead to an irregular heart rhythm that can be fatal. That's true not only for this antibiotic, but others in this group, and even another group of antibiotics called fluoroquinolones. If we're going to prescribe this, we should probably limit it to individuals that are low risk of cardiovascular disease and that don't have a baseline QT prolongation.
So the QT prolongation is pre-existing?
In some individuals, it is. And then there are individuals that have a normal QT interval and don't experience prolongation until they're exposed to this. So there's a wide variety of patients that could potentially be at risk.
So there would be no utility then to using an EKG as a screening tool?
No. What this study shows is that in the general population, you're okay. If they have risk factors for cardiovascular disease, you may want to avoid this antibiotic. So I don't think we need to do routine screening, but if that information is available and suggests they may be at risk, I'd avoid this antibiotic.
Okay. Let's turn then to JAMA Pediatrics. I think this is a really provocative study trying to get our arms around what is it with allergy from kids from different parts of the world. We don't really understand allergies really very well, at least in my mind to begin with. What are we going to do to explain this?
I thought this was a fascinating study too, because it promotes this thing called hygiene hypothesis related to allergies. So let me circle back around to that in just a second, Elizabeth. But just to note that in the U.S., the prevalence of childhood asthma is about 9 to 11%. In childhood, atopic dermatitis, skin rashes related to allergies, is about 20%. The prevalence of those same allergic diseases is much lower in other countries such as Mexico and China. There's this hypothesis that the different environmental and infectious exposures in these developing countries can actually help guide the immature immune system away from a pro-allergic or inflammatory state. Children that are raised in developing countries are more likely to experience environmental exposures and infectious exposures that render them less likely to develop allergies. These investigators attempted to see whether they could prove that was true or not. So they looked at children that were born outside the United States and compared them to American children born inside the United States. And what they discovered was that the children that were born outside the U.S. had significantly lower odds of having any of the allergic conditions. This was about a 50 to 65% lower risk. When those children that were born outside the U.S. lived in the U.S. for longer than 10 years, they lost that. Their risk of allergies was the same as people that had been here for a long time.
I will ask our listeners, long-term listeners who may remember this, and I know you're going to remember it. We covered a study looking at cats and dogs in the environment with infants. And also, we've covered a study that was related to kids raised on farms versus those raised in the city, all of which suggested that this early exposure was actually protective. But the question is, what is it that they're exposed to when they're in Europe that they're not exposed to when they get here?
Oh, Elizabeth, that's the million-dollar question with regard to this hypothesis, and I don't know the answer.
Well, I'll advocate for all those dogs and cats that are sitting around in the SPCA hoping to be adopted. Finally, then, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. It's actually the USPSTF's recommendations regarding HIV testing. And I just have a little bit of a question about this one before we even talk about it. And that's that, wait a sec, I thought we'd already established that global testing, that routine testing of everybody for HIV status was important. I think that was the CDC. So what are we doing with the USPSTF?
This is a circumstance where the CDC was probably ahead of the USPSTF. What the USPSTF did was they reviewed new evidence that looked at the effectiveness of the treatments. They looked at the effects of screening and counseling. They looked at transmission risk and came to the conclusion that based on all the new evidence that clinicians should screen adolescents and adults between the ages of 15 to 65 for HIV infection. They recommend that clinicians screen all pregnant women for HIV. And they, by the way, should test for HIV status with each pregnancy as well.
It took him a little while to get there, I guess. One of our colleagues here at Johns Hopkins, Joel Gallant, when I have talked with him in the past about universal screening, says this ought to be just like a CBC or a cholesterol profile, that HIV testing is something status, is something that everyone should know. And if we would just adopt it universally, it would remove all of the remaining stigma regarding it and also allow people to adopt early treatment, which we know is effective.
What we didn't say was the elephant in the room, that is 20 to 25% of individuals that are living with HIV infection are unaware that they are a positive. What about false positives? Well, the tests are so good, they're 99.5% certain. And if you get one test, you confirm it with another. I think Joe Gallant was absolutely right. Routine screening in this age group carries a lot of benefits and really very few downsides at all.
On that note, then, we're going to advocate for HIV screening. Everybody ought to know their HIV status. This week, I'm going to do the allergy in kids from JAMA Pediatrics in the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.